اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World and Still Is. Of course, this program is nothing more than about the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul. In all the previous programs that we've spoken about and discussed so far, we've discussed the fact that, you know, many revolutions, many ideologies, and many great momentous events in history have claims, but very few of them live up to the expectation that they are meant to mean to the people. Today's session, we're going to look more closely on the slogan that started the revolution here in Iran, particularly, but because it's an Islamic revolution, it was meant for the entire Muslim Ummah. And I repeat that, the entire Muslim Ummah, because Iran, the Islamic revolution may geographically be confined to Iran, but it was meant for the entire Muslim world and beyond. And that's what we're really discussing here, that how big an impact Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, really made in terms of fact that we have now a very changing world. Once again, I'm joined by Dr. Hassani, an academic and Islamic researcher, and a very warm welcome to you, sir, for this particular session of this program once
again.
Thank
you, sir.
Thank you. Dr. Hassani, we're at the point now where we've looked at these aspects about Imam Khomeini in terms of his life, in terms of his biography. We've looked at aspects of this multidimensional personality, and as you quite rightly said, we're not going to say it all in one breath, because that's not possible, and at the same time, that wouldn't do justice to such a great personality, because you talked of him, I remember, in one of our previous programs, that he's a mountain. How do you describe a mountain? Anyway, I'm sure you'll be able to do that for us anyway, Dr. Hassani, but the main thing is, the slogan starts with Allahu Akbar, and you very nicely put that in a context where we can all understand that, of one and zero, not as a binary code as most people understand in maths, but the fact that we are the created, we are zero, and don't exist without the one. And in that context, Imam Khomeini himself, such a humble man, would not say anything different. He wanted to get to his beloved. But there are two important concepts that are coming out of this particular revolution, as you quite rightly put it in the previous program. And it's not a claim, this is a reality. First of all, Allah is Akbar, God is great, that's a reality. And then they said Khomeini Rahbar, that meant that Khomeini is the leader. What went wrong in the last few centuries where only now we've come to an understanding that without the leader, we're not going to get anywhere, are we?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Good subject. Very important. Again, answer in one word. Use the word Ummah.
Yeah.
Ummah.
What it means in Arabic?
We can write a book about it.
Yeah, but what does it mean?
Let me explain it.
Please.
Ummah, one nation under God, in a true sense.
Oh, America claims that. They say they're one nation
under God. Well, that's a different story. To be an Ummah,
yeah.
The word Umm in Arabic, yes. Which means mother,
mm.
It is said Umm for mother in Arabic,
right.
Because the child intends his mother. The intention has to be there.
Ah.
Ummah, one nation, knowingly, purposely, trying to go under the banner of one God.
One God, yes.
This is one way.
Sure.
Again, about that zero, let me explain it again in a different way. I would like to give you examples, materialistic example.
Sure.
This
sure.
is one way in yeah, order so to understand.
Let's get
in
a
order
feeling
to understand
of what we
this spiritual thing,
yeah.
The deep ma'rifah, knowledge of, you know, by the way, the whole universe is full of so many different phenomena.
Mm.
We're not claiming we understand all of them, but we can try.
Sure.
To tell you what that how that zero in reality is, and how that particular one works, which makes the slogan of Allahu Akbar. Mm. I'll give you an example. For a second, for the sake of argument, okay? You don't even have to close your eyes.
Mm.
You can just purposely think about making or building something in your imagination. Let's say a bike.
Right.
Bicycle.
Right. I've got a picture of a bike in my mind.
So you have it?
I've got it.
Who created it? You.
I did. Yeah.
So in the course of our discourse with each other, forget about it. For a second.
Okay.
That bike. Where is it?
It's gone.
In your imagination, it's gone.
Gone.
It's gone.
It's gone. It's into my subconscious.
That's the zero I'm talking about.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for God's mercy and will and power and one thing to give life to us, to that particular zero.
Zero.
For one
moment.
Less than moment. This
right.
is for, you know.
Mm.
When you're talking about this, this is because all we are familiar with this kind of understanding.
Sure.
For one small fraction of a second, an imaginary, you know, moment, which could be very, 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 in the blink of an eye.
Sure.
If God takes his intention, which is merciful, which is mercy upon us,
of course
for
is.
One second, if he takes that intention away, we would end up to be nothing. That's the zero I was talking about. So in order to explain this, that whatever we say, we have to mean it. We have to understand it as much as we could.
Sure.
The word Ummah is of this kind of significance.
My
now
goodness.
Back to your question.
My goodness.
What happened to what happened to Muslims? We can't say what happened to Islamic Ummah.
No, we're not talking about Islamic Ummah.
Brother, Ummah is something to become. It's not a giving thing.
That's right. And that's what we're trying to get to,
and
isn't it?
This is the reason this is the reason for saying Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him, was and still is a leader in order to lead us to that particular intended, serious business.
Well,
to become one nation.
Well, let me just throw something into this argument. Because Imam Khomeini, I remember, may God bless his great soul, said that the problem at this moment in time with the Muslim world is this, that you do not lead yourselves to the Quran, but you take the Quran to yourselves.
Mm-hmm. In other words, whatever you like,
whatever you like, you try to justify.
To find a passage in Quran,
to justify
and apply to yourself.
Now, let me take that just a little step further. Wasn't that the sin that Bani Israel was guilty of, in which they lost all connection with God whatsoever?
In general term, the answer is yes. But there is so many different details attached to it.
Yeah, yeah.
When you go astray, you know, Satan won't let you go.
No, he doesn't.
You know what? Some people think Satan, wants to take your beliefs away, which is true.
Yeah.
He wants to take your religion, your beliefs away.
Yeah, he wants to do
it. But that's not the end of it.
No.
This is where research, studying, deep understanding helps you, help us to understand. You can be a kafir, you can be an infidel, but you could still have some kind of dignity left in you by doing a good virtue. By how you're dealing with people, with your own people,
yes,
to begin with.
Yes, but you're talking about absolute humiliation and abasement.
Exactly. You know, when Satan takes the religion away from you, your beliefs.
That's only one part.
This is only one part.
Part of it.
Okay? But he won't let go. That's not good enough for him. Because he swear by God. He swear by God that I'm going to take him all the way to the hellfire.
So he's going to abase him.
Okay? So the disgrace will follow. The disgrace is this.
Yeah.
You're not only without any beliefs, which gets you to the point of being zero again.
Yeah.
But he wants you to be disgraced totally.
In the sight of Allah subhanahu wa
ta'ala. In the sight of Allah. Then in the sight of humanity.
Yeah. And the sight of humanity as well. Yes,
you know, you have to be very careful to study this thing.
Sure.
Again, research is to study something, a phenomenon or something, very, very carefully. That makes it
in order to draw proper conclusions.
It's not just to look for something.
No.
You have to research. You have to get back to the point again.
Yeah, but the thing is that, you know, when you do that research, it's just a stepping stone to a wider body of knowledge.
And it's only a tool.
Yeah, it's only a tool. We're not talking about something that ends.
Let's not
there.
Get carried, you know, away with it.
Yeah.
Say, oh, okay, I'm a researcher.
Yeah.
So what?
Where do we go from here?
Yeah. All we have to trying to, you know, find the right path, which is the straight path.
Sure.
And stay on it. You can be on the right path.
Yeah.
But again, devil is not going to go anywhere.
No.
Because it's swear by the power of God Almighty that I'm going to take every single of this so-called creature of yours, except for those that I cannot mess with.
Well. Dr. Hassani, you take us to a very, very important point in this discussion, a very significant point in this discussion. You know, in every revolution, there's a kind of demon, if you like.
And we've seen so many of them.
Yeah, there's a kind of hate figures in revolutions. I mean, if you take the 1789 French Revolution, the aristocracy were the demons of that revolution.
And the guillotines.
And the guillotine, you know, cutting their heads off
cutting
or whatever.
Cutting heads off and so on and so forth.
And even Robespierre of the 1789 revolution in France made the claim that terror, state terror, was a tool and a valid means by which to destroy the enemies of the new republic.
And by the way, the terror back then had a different definition.
Exactly.
There wasn't no good terrorist, bad terrorist.
So I'm not drawing any parallels with the French Revolution. But what I'm saying here is that
But the idea, the concept was this, brother. Really to terrorize you in a true sense.
Yeah.
To scare you away from what your goal might be.
But exactly.
And not necessarily by physically assassinate you.
Yeah.
So we have to be, you know, very careful about this stuff.
That's
because nowadays, the word terror, terrorist is used in a broad way and so, selective one as far as the dirty politician concerned.
What I'm saying is that this was a materialistic revolution.
Okay.
1789, this liberty, equality, fraternity.
Give me liberty or give me death.
Yeah, give me brotherhood. Give me liberty, give me equality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
That was the three slogans of the French Revolution. The reality is something entirely different, but that was in a materialistic sense. I'm trying to just draw parallels with the fact that, you know, in a context where Europe was talking about enlightenment, we're talking about something here far more significant than that. We're talking about a reality for which even the French Republic is far and and miles away from and still hasn't understood this concept yet about what the true reality and nature of man is. They've had these wonderful slogans of egality, of equality, liberty, and brotherhood and fraternity. But Islam is a way ahead of all that.
Way ahead.
Now, what I'm seeing here is that there is this claim, like every revolution, it has its demons. And as you say, you know, it has its enemies. But Imam Khomeini didn't hate anyone. He didn't say things out of just simply trying to justify that the Iranian masses would all cling to this particular slogan because he just felt that was the right thing to say for the moment. When you are saying that the United States of America is the great Satan, he means it in the context of what you've just said, that it's not enough for us just to abandon Islam. It's not enough for us to forget about Tawheed. It's not enough for us to become, as you say, unbelievers. They want to really humiliate this country so that people forget about it wherever it is on the map. They think Iran is some petrol station in Dallas somewhere.
So many different things, you know. And I have to touch as many as I can.
Yeah.
You know the reason for that humiliation? Lifestyle.
Yeah, of course it is.
Look at about the Western lifestyle.
Yeah.
Okay, they take our beliefs away. Mm. They won't let go.
No.
The disgrace part comes is here.
Yeah.
Homosexuality.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
I mean, how low can you get?
Exactly. But as you see, it'll
You know
go
the story
further.
About Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
And the story goes on.
And on.
I'm trying to be so precise about this
That's
thing.
Right. Because we're going back to the
because
Quran.
Because we're going back to the Quran again.
Quran again.
And we have to cover so many different issues.
Issues, yes. Because what I'm saying is that Imam...
The other statement I should add in this particular one, because you mentioned the word claim again, and you draw a good parallel between different revolutions. My answer to you is this. Words have to be matched with
action.
Again, another expression, which makes sense, which is true. Mm. Practice what you
preach. And Imam Khomeini lived up to that.
And this is where the church went wrong too. I mean, this is all long story.
Of course it is.
But in order to understand, remember the one of the introduction I gave you, and it was kind of lengthy, you know, and it seems like at the time it was getting boring or whatever. But the thing is this: we have no other way around it except to analyze all this stuff.
Yes,
and constantly come back to it.
Yes,
this is very important.
Yeah, and broaden the
and
model.
Don't forget about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. It has to be comprehensive.
Has to be. Okay? So the difference between all the revolutions, the materialistic, okay, the worldly revolution with this particular one, which we say, proudly we say, the Islamic revolution.
Yes.
Which happened in Iran 30-some years ago. Still is going on.
Yes.
Do you hear anything about French Revolution?
No,
it was
we don't.
So good.
I mean,
why you don't hear about it?
Yeah, because
I'm not here to answer all these questions.
No, no.
All if I succeed in doing one thing on this program, you know, God willing, that's more than I can handle.
Sure.
And that thing is this: to bring to your attention the kind of question, the kind of path that you should take in order to study
exactly
different cases.
Exactly.
And this is why humanity still has a lot to work on.
Yeah.
I mean, talking about the propaganda machine,
yeah,
constantly bombarding
with lies,
with mere lies,
lies and hypocrisy,
lies, insulting, yes, follows with insulting,
yes,
threatening,
yes,
bullying, wasting sources,
yes.
Who's going to be responsible for this?
That's right.
Who's going to answer it? Nobody. All those empty claims. Okay.
Yeah.
Of course, they're going to say, you know, the other side of the defense, the grass is greener. I mean, this is a promise.
Yeah.
But is it really? Is it greener?
Well, that's up to debate, isn't it? I mean, that's
this is all in the shape of questions.
Yeah, because as you say, that's the what do you call the proof in the pudding is in the eating. So that's exactly it.
I give you another example. The criteria in order to do the system of check and balance. You know where you go wrong? Contradiction. 2 + 2 = 4.
Four.
It's
not
four
five.
For you, or it's four for me, or it's four for both of us.
That's the reality.
2 + 2 = 4 on Saturday. How about Friday?
It'll be four on Friday.
Four on Friday.
But they want to make you believe that it's five.
They want to make you believe.
It's five on a Friday.
That African lives differently
yeah.
than European
yeah.
and Asian
yeah.
and Latin America
yeah.
and U.S.
Yes.
and Mexico, for that matter.
Yeah.
And we live this. We cannot betray ourselves in order to think differently, because we want to think differently. This is very important also.
Sure.
Contradiction. Anytime 2 plus 2 is not 4, something's wrong. Something, as they say in the state, something seriously wrong.
Right. Let me throw something else at you, because, of course, I mean, you're old enough to remember this. And, you know, there was the Cuban Revolution. That was the way back in the 60s. There was also a revolution in Nicaragua around about the same
Sandinistas.
Time. Yeah, the Sandinistas. Back in 79.
The timing was the same.
So it was the same. But we have to ask the question, what makes the difference between, say, the Sandinista revolution, which was based on a Marxist ideology or something similar to that, and the divine revolution? Because the divine revolution is something that Imam Khomeini impressed a great deal on the rest of the world, which is why we are still living it. We are still in the process of this, because, as you say, whatever has happened in the Muslim world in the past, well, that's the past. But we are trying to get to the Islamic goal, which is from the Quran. And that is about purification and perfection. And what the slogan is saying, Allahu Akbar, in the beginning, is that without the spiritual dimension, there's no success for mankind.
Very good question. Very good question. And I'm trying very hard to explain it the best way I can.
Yeah, but do your best. Do your best.
I want to give it a shot.
Sure.
First of all, divine task, divine mission requires divine understanding. Let me talk about narration.
Yes.
From the Impeccables.
Yes, from the Infallibles, yes. The Infallible Imams.
Something to the fact that the price, listen to this word. And again, the word means a lot of things. If you understand what it means, then it takes you to where you're supposed to.
Sure.
The price of your body is heaven.
The price of your body is heaven.
The price of your body, the way you live,
is
materialistically
heaven. Is heaven.
Is heaven.
Sure.
Hell is not made for you.
No.
You're human, for God's sake. Again, goes back to the definition.
Yeah.
God willing, I have to get to this Quranic reference on due time.
Sure.
Okay? The price of your body is heaven.
Yeah.
But the price of your soul is only God. Think about what I said.
Exactly.
And the Impeccable says
that's
this.
Right. That's right.
So that makes it what? That makes it more interesting, yet more difficult. In order to value yourself, this is important. This is where humanity go wrong.
Yeah.
You remember? Satan wants to take you to the wrong way.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
To a dark alley of disbelief.
And a basement.
Then disgrace you.
Disgrace you.
The disgrace part is this, that you lose your soul.
Soul.
Brother, if you own something in this materialistic world, let's say you cannot pay your mortgage on your house. I like to give you these examples.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the way of Quranic teaching and understanding. Any occasion wants to tell to teach you something very important, give you examples.
Sure.
And the definition, for example, is this. To show you something feelable, sensible, with all these five senses, in order to think to take you to a different level.
Sure.
This is the definition of mathal, examples. I give you examples. If you behind you paying your mortgage, what a bank will do, and they're good at it. They're doing it in U.S., they're doing it in U.K.
Right.
I'm sure they're going to be doing it in Scotland.
Sure.
Okay?
Well, it's happening
what
already.
What they do? If you're behind paying your car payment, they take it away.
Well, first of all, there's a warning, and then you're thrown out.
The final act.
They're
going to take it away.
Yeah.
But with God, it doesn't work like that.
Mm.
See? When talking about references, you talk about the reality. You're talking about the greatness of a unique, I should say. When you say fetra, the mere translation, you know, to give it to you in a nutshell, the fitrah is a particular, unique creation. The Torah suggests that. Those who are familiar with the word fitrah,
yes,
that Torah, at the end, it suggests that this is a unique one. This is not the Torah of, you know, in Arabic, we have two kind of genders.
Right.
For every
yes,
word.
Male and, yeah.
Male and female.
Female.
But that's not the case.
No.
Okay? And so what's the price of your soul? Let me put it this way. If you owe God something by disobeying Him in the hereafter, do you have money to pay in order to release yourself from being hostage?
No.
What they take, what have you lost? What they take as a hostage, if they want to, if you want to use this phrase,
yeah,
they take your own reality, your own soul.
So
this is very important.
Yes.
So beyond this material, again, this is not repetition. This is important issues.
Yes.
And we might come back to it again.
Yeah.
So the least reward for your body is what? Heaven. But how about your soul? You made up a two different kind of whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Whatever things I should call it.
Yeah.
Simple.
Yeah. Composition.
Composition.
You're a composition.
I even don't use the word composition.
Yeah.
Things. Things is a common word, brother, in every single language.
Sure.
In Arabic, we call it shay.
Sure.
And there is no exclusion.
Sure.
It includes everything.
Sure.
In Farsi, we call it different name. In English, we call it thing.
Yeah.
This humanity, what we call Bashar or Insan. Bashar is referring to the skin.
Sure.
Insan, it goes a little bit further. And the root meaning of it, that's a totally different subject. We're not going to get into that.
Sure.
Because our time is limited, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But the thing is this. You are made differently. You are a unique. That's why the angel didn't understand. Why are you doing this?
Yeah, because I couldn't understand what the human
was
all about.
What was the response?
Well, I know what you do not know.
I know what you do not know. Do you think the angel find out? Of course they did.
Yeah.
During the course of history, the course of time, they saw the movement of Ashura. God putting Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, on one side, they said, look, that's why I created this.
Yes.
This is the Khalifa. This is the successor of my mission, my being. Now the angel, you know, they could think about it.
Yes.
But before, they didn't pay attention to the word successor. They thought it's something, you know, just like whatever, their imagination or their background of whatever they witnessed, maybe.
Well, I mean, this brings us back to what we said in our previous program as well, that the combination of both the Quran and the Holy Prophets, Ahlul Bayt, is what gives us the ingredients that we need to get that God into, to have that reward of our soul as God.
And Brother Ejaz, this is very important. God put this in my mind to say it. The same way that Imam Hussein was a good example for angels to see what that successor might be. Okay? Because we're talking about the man who changed the world and still is. And will be. Okay? I keep repeating this.
That's
thing.
Right.
Because this is the belief that we're talking about.
Yeah.
God also showed the angels Imam Khomeini. You see?
Yes.
In the 20th century.
Yeah.
At the time that everybody's giving up.
Giving up on religion.
Giving up of everything. Hope.
Yeah.
God is holding Imam Khomeini upright and say, look, this is a good example why I created this.
And
it was worth it.
Yes. And of course, of the fact that, as you quite rightly said, this world is not going to be without a successor. And therefore, Imam Khomeini was the example for us in the late 20th century. Dr. Hasni, thanks very much for your valuable contribution. Again, we have run out of time in this session. But in the next session, I hope that we will now carry on with this argument, with the impact of what Imam Khomeini did with the great Satan. So let's get into that argument in the next session. But it leaves me just to say, may the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. And thank you for our audience who have been listening to us today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Welcome to The Shaheed, a show that aims to unravel the different dimensions of Qasem Soleimani's personality as well as his activities. I'm Sarbazul Rizvi, and in this episode, we'll be talking about Syria, from where Qasem Soleimani embarked on the journey that led to his martyrdom. As per some reports, the Israeli regime tracked him down at the Damascus airport and got him martyred at the Baghdad airport in collusion with the Americans. The decade-long war in Syria has attracted widespread attention of the masses more than any other international event and has left over 500,000 people dead and millions homeless. Many portray Qasem Soleimani as a bestial figure in the Syrian crisis and blamed him for this gruesome war. But Syria stood its ground, and today hardly anyone denies the fact that it was him who saved Syria from turning into another Libya, a torn, battered, and an occupied country. Let's have a look at the role he played in the crisis of Syria and how he turned the tables on the Western and Saudi-backed terrorists in the region who wanted to disintegrate the Syrian nation. A prominent Australian academic and activist, a senior lecturer of the University of Sydney, and author of several books and articles criticizing imperialism. Dr. Tim Anderson, thank you for accepting our invitation.
You're welcome.
If I'm not wrong, you are currently at Damascus, the Syrian capital. Tell us, what does exactly Syria stand today in ending 2021, starting 2022?
Well, Syria is on the verge of defeating the war, the terrorist war. It only exists in safe havens where there are the occupations of the two major NATO armies of Turkey and the USA and of Israel in the south. So on that, because of that, really, there is an opening, particularly from regional states, notably the Emiratis, Jordan. An opening where there had not been openings for some time. Nevertheless, there is a terrible economic war still going on, of course, driven by Washington out of spite for losing this war.
Recently, we have heard about new events taking place. Even the Gulf countries or Persian Gulf countries are taking, you know, different attitudes. It seems at least that they are taking different attitudes. Among them was the trip of the foreign ministry of UAE. How do you analyze and how do you, you know, interpret those events?
Yes, well, that's one of several openings that are going on here at the moment. In the case of the Emiratis, it's significant that they reopened their embassy back in late 2018, along with, I think, Bahrain at the time, because they saw the course of directions were going, that the Damascus government was holding firm. They'd resisted all the pressures from the outside. And, of course, in retaliation for that, the former President Trump effectively blackmailed the UAE into recognizing Israel, those so-called Abraham Accords. So there was a cost for that to the Emiratis. But nevertheless, the Emiratis have pursued their course. They want to reestablish relations. They have a number of investment projects. They don't want to lose their relevance and influence in the region. That's what it comes down to. And you could say something similar about Jordan in the south, that Jordan was keen to reopen as soon as the opportunity came along.
And it seems likely that Syria is going to take part in the upcoming Arab summit in Algeria.
Well, that may or may not be the case. To my mind, the Arab League has significantly tainted by having turned against two of the most important members, Libya and Syria, a decade ago. It came to be dominated by the Gulf monarchies, notably Saudi Arabia. And so whether or not Syria joins, I suspect that organization is running up to its expiry date.
There are different factors related to the Syrian crisis, but our concentration in this program is on the Major General Qasem Soleimani, martyred General Qasem Soleimani. How do you analyze his role in defending Syria and in reaching to what we are today? At least we are, you know, in a much more better condition towards what we're in 2013, 14, 15. How do you analyze the role of General Qasem Soleimani in Syria?
The life of the late Qasem Soleimani in Syria was extraordinary. Of course, we know that he had a very important role in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Iraq, as well as in Syria, as well as in Iran, of course. I remember most closely the involvement of Soleimani in the battles in the Lebanon Mountains, the Kalamun Mountains. He played a very important role in the along the Euphrates River, the liberation of Deir ez-Zor, and pushing immediately after the liberation of Deir ez-Zor from ISIS down to the border crossing, which is still controlled by the Axis countries, by the resistance countries. And that's become a focus of conflict in recent times because, as you know, the US occupation in Iraq and Syria has placed itself all along those borders from the northeast down to the south in Al-Tanf, the closest connection between Baghdad and Damascus. And the only exception is that crossing at Al-Bukamal between Syria and Iraq. And recently there was exposure of a US massacre close by to that too. So it was Qasem Soleimani that took the decision to move very quickly from Deir ez-Zor and secure that crossing. And I think that's fitting because what we most remember him for, I think, is not simply as an Iranian general, but as a commander of the resistance across all of the independent states of the region.
Exactly, exactly. We will continue our discussion with Tim Anderson after a short, you know, item. Stay with us.
The picture I paint of Soleimani in relation to Syria is how it's been put by the media. Actually, it's extracting a picture of the general from the context that is Syria. Syria is a country that has never experienced a stable official political order outside of single-party rule. In the 20 years between 1946, when France exited Syria for good, and 1966, when the Ba'ath coup d'etat occurred and a single-party system took control, Syria had never experienced a stable order. In those two decades, the country saw 8 coup d'etats. That's not all. In the same period, Syria's borders were moved. Of course, that was nothing new to Syria. The sum of all that passed gave way to Ba'ath party rule as an authority capable of restoring public order. In 1970, Hafez Assad, who was defense minister till then, pulled off Syria's last coup d'etat and seized power. A Ba'athist since 1946, he restored order and began filtering the system with the army and set to govern all political and cultural offices directly. It was easy to predict a power vacuum after Hafez Assad. Young Bashar Assad experienced 2 uprisings right from the start of his office. His rule even coincided with turning points such as the 33-day war of South Lebanon and 22-day war of Gaza. With the 22-day war, the Hamas office in Damascus turned into a center for international talks in defense of Gaza, which forced Tel Aviv into accepting a ceasefire with its head hanging. Practically, it was the end of the political life of Ehud Olmert, once Israeli prime minister. Finally, with 2011 came domino uprisings called the Arab Spring, beginning with Tunisia. As the spring moved south, it snowballed to cover most all Arab lands. In Syria, as if at war, both sides were demonstrating, both Assad supporters and opposers, the latter being mostly in marginal, poorer cities. Arab and Western governments that would not accept the pact between Damascus and the resistance seized the opportunity by arming opponents. As such, they bribed officials and military officers to part ways with the Syrian government, and they boycotted Syria, hence straining its economy. The Arab Spring was a chance, no less, for the West to slip its own fighters into the Arab world. Via spy agencies in Turkey and Saudi Arabia, the West transferred fighters from Libya to Syria. With Libya's Muammar Gaddafi out of the way, it was that much easier. By the final months of 2011, Syria was choking on the bulk of terror groups that had gotten in. So by end 2011, Syria no longer had a social uprising on its hands, but a proxy and international war. Now here's where we get closer to Soleimani's involvement. Al-Qaeda also got into Syria via its Iraq branch. And who better to deal with it than General Soleimani, with his knowledge and experience with Iraq? Without his assistance, Syria may have drowned in a dark age of never-ending civil wars with multinational Takfiri terror groups massacring religious minorities and destroying Shia places of worship such as the shrine of Saint Zainab, peace be upon her, granddaughters of the Prophet Muhammad. It was under such circumstances that Haj Qasim, the great commander of the resistance, stood by his old ally. Thanks to his skill and military knowledge, together with his strategic outlook and bravery, the final victory fell to the resistance in Syria's war. Some ask, what would be the fate of Syria had Soleimani not arrived? Well, Syria's domestic fights are enough to explain the situation. Then again, there's Daesh, a famous recent example of why West Asia needed Soleimani and now the strategic foundation he laid for the region. Syria's nightmare enemy of 2014 to 2017 was Daesh, which was defeated basically by Soleimani and his resistance.
Let's continue our interview with Dr. Tim Anderson. Dr. Anderson, what would have been possibly the map of the region if someone like General Qasem Soleimani was not there in Syria?
Well, it's very difficult to say. It's said that his role extended to inviting the Russian air power into Syria, which was critically important, of course, back in late 2015 in turning the course of that war. But I think, in general, we are going to remember Soleimani as a resistance commander, and therefore our attention is drawn to the integration of the independent peoples, the independent states to the region, the building of a alliance of independent countries against the imperial powers that have tried to disintegrate the region, as one Iranian commentator said. So I think the beginnings of the integration, the military, the economic, the infrastructural integration of this region in many respects are on a foundation of the human relations created by General Soleimani.
Yeah, you mentioned something really important, the human relations that General Soleimani started at this region. But one important thing, do you think something like Libya was going to take place to Syria as well? What we observed about the case of Syria, about the case of Libya and the direct intervention of the NATO, and now a war-torn country totally. I mean, there is nothing known as Libya today.
Yes, I think that's true. There was a Libyan plan for Syria very soon after. And, of course, one of the reasons for the failure of that plan was that the NATO powers exposed their hand very quickly, having said that they weren't going to directly intervene. They used that pretext of a no-fly zone to directly intervene and to destroy the state. As you pointed out, the state has been smashed. There is no political will there, which is really what they wanted. And when they tried that plan on Syria sometime later on, however, it was quite significant that two of the independent big powers in the Security Council, namely Russia and China, didn't fall for the same trick again. I think that was important. It was important that Syria had allies, Syria had friends. Iran was the first amongst those, but Russia and China began to play an important role. And, of course, we shouldn't underestimate the fact that the Syrian people themselves backed their army. The army did not disintegrate. They defended the concept of a nation that they loved and wanted to defend and resist all of the incursions at terrible costs. But certainly because of that resistance primarily, and secondarily because of the friends and the alliance, Syria survived where Libya was crushed.
Indeed. I mean, at the end, what was done was basically initially done by the Syrian people. And, General Qasem Soleimani was as a friend to the Syrian nation and Syrian people. Beside this war, this gruesome war that was in Syria, another war was also going on at the media level. A war that was targeting the personality of General Qasem Soleimani, to target his personality and to ruin his face and what he was doing. Specifically in Western and Arab media, almost all the mainstream media was trying to target what General Qasem Soleimani was doing, specifically after 2013-14, when his role was much more revealed at the region. So how do you analyze that part of the story, that media campaign and media war that was going on against General Qasem Soleimani and the resistance movement, generally speaking?
Well, the resistance movement is one thing. I think General Soleimani, in many respects, was a low-profile person, wasn't he? He didn't do many public interviews until, I think, the last year of his life. There were some important interviews in 2019, but it was acknowledged generally that he was leading the fight against ISIS at that time, back in 2015, 16, 17. I think it's after his murder, the brutal and treacherous murder by President Trump, for which we should never forget or forgive, that the Western media subs to try and rewrite history, to try and recreate this man in some sort of way. Indeed,
exactly.
I'm one of a number of people who were kicked off Western social media simply for mentioning his name and the name of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Iraq. Those people are categorized in their death as dangerous individuals and people to be banned from Western social media. So it's extraordinary, really, in a sense that they still sense this great threat. I'm talking about the war media, what I call the war media or the colonial media. They sense this great threat and they classify Muhandis, they classify General Soleimani as dangerous people still in their death.
So how do you think we can confront this, I mean, battlefield?
Well, of course, we have to tell the truth, don't we? We have to write the histories of the peoples that are beginning to be written here in Syria, in other parts of the region. It's very important that the resistance peoples, the independent peoples, write their own histories with their friends and colleagues around the globe, because one advantage we have to admit that the imperial powers have is a very well-integrated media system. They have very strong reinforcement mechanisms, and in many respects the resistance has been lacking. So there is a battle going on at that level, as you said, a type of a war, a media war for hearts and minds, if you like, a moral war, because in many respects the Western imperial powers now place great use on this idea of human rights and humanitarian arguments for their terrible, awful, bloody wars that they're carrying on against, I think, what is it, 9 wars in this region in the last 2 decades, for example. So there is a need for independent voices to be heard and for the resistance media to have a much stronger role.
Thank you, Dr. Tim Anderson, prominent Australian academic and activist. Thank you for joining our invitation and being with
very
us
welcome.
On this special episode of The Shaheed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was just talking to Dr. Tim Anderson, the prominent lecturer and the senior lecturer of the University of Sydney and also author of several books against imperialism. We talked about the role that General Qasem Soleimani played in saving and protecting Syria from not becoming another Libya, of course. In the next and the following part of our program, we are going to talk about something maybe somehow unusual, about ethics in war. Talking about ethics at a battlefield such as Syria and other battlefields of the region is somehow, you know, unusual. But in the following part of our program, we're going to shed some light on another dimension of the personality of Shaheed General Qasem Soleimani. Stay with us.
Kill who you will. Kill as you will. This is the general strategy of warmongers, those who fight just to win, making war of aggression that much uglier. But with different rules, the bloody face of war can actually be a scene of human exaltation and bring about the best in people. Sticking to ethics in war will prevent using just any means to win. Here are examples of how far things can go in a war without ethics and chivalry, or in weakness. Civilians are targeted, even by dirty chemical bombs. Rape is all too often used as a weapon, at best, even child rape. It is mostly just because of the motto, all is well in war, and simply because of morally loose command and constituents. Now, this is not to say the odd incident cannot occur in chaos, even with the best morals and checks in place. But given noble command and clean constituents, that is, soldiers, a war can even turn into an epic. And Qasem Soleimani considered himself a soldier of the faith. So ethics of war will have been everything to him. Plenty has been said on the ethics of war in holy books or poems and philosophical writings. Qasem Soleimani was among human beings who followed these teachings to the best of their ability. In fact, many who know him say the secret to his success was following Islamic ethics, even with an enemy on the battlefield. It's noteworthy. A major reason why Soleimani stuck by his ethics in war is that he was influenced by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The general himself
recalls his days with the Kerman IRGC branch as such. Soleimani is quoted to have said in summary, "We captured a thug in Sistan and Balochistan province, a big drug smuggler who'd martyred several of our men. We lured him in by invitation and locked him up. The leader said to release him, much to my surprise. The reason was the Shia principle that you cannot hurt someone you've invited as your guest, even if he has killed your father." Sardar Asad Beghi, a fellow compatriot, tells of Haj Qasem's unwavering morals in the middle of the Syrian war in relation to one of the highest-ranking figures of the Takfiri al-Nusra group. That would be a Sheikh Abdullah, the number two of Takfiri groups. "We uncovered his whereabouts between 12 midnight till 5 a.m. one day and awaited orders to destroy him by drone attack. General Soleimani happened to find out and disagreed when he learned the man's visit to the house was to accompany his wife in labor, because that would mean destroying also his family and innocent people." The school of thought Haj Qasem believed in simply wouldn't allow him to set aside his ethics, even in dealing with his biggest enemy. A gardener named his dog Donald after the US president to belittle Donald Trump. Soleimani stopped him, although the same president would have given the order to assassinate him.
In this episode, we talked about Syria. Only God knows what would have been the geopolitics of East Asia if Haj Qasem Soleimani, along with the Syrian nation government, hadn't stood fast. Goodbye.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As always, it's a genuine pleasure and an absolute honor to be with you guys and to have a share in your precious and valuable time. And I am ever so grateful that you guys take time out of your day to hopefully join in our little discussions that we have. I don't necessarily consider myself as a creative person. I don't know whether it's because of my anxiety that I constantly am in a state of brain fog, or because I haven't dabbled in enough things that demand any degree of creativity in general. But I do understand that in life, you need to be creative. Sometimes you need to be impulsive. Sometimes you need to be spontaneous. Sometimes you need to be innovative. You need to think outside of the box. You need to do something out of character, get out of your comfort zone and stuff like that. It might sound cliche, but it is necessary. It's necessary for our growth because there's like, well, some people are born creative. My brother was born creative, God bless him. And some aren't very much, right? But it's definitely something that we can train ourselves to achieve. You know? Human beings can do anything they set their mind to. I bet if we really set our mind to it, we could grow an extra limb. But no one's really wanted to do that before, I think. But the point is that some people are born creative and they lead pretty creative minds. pretty creative lives. And by creative, I mean almost every corner of their lives possesses an element that sets their soul on fire. Otherwise, they cannot continue, right? And then some people aren't necessarily born that creative. Everyone has a certain degree of creativity, but they're not like genius creative. And it can be developed. Let's hear a short story. You know what? Let's do that so we can get a better idea of what we mean by creativity. And we're going to be right back.
A man was exploring caves by a seashore when he found a bag with a bunch of hardened clay balls. The balls looked like someone had intentionally rolled the clay and left them out in the sun to bake. Perhaps some children made them while they were at the beach, the man thought. They didn't look much, so he took the bag out of the cave with him. As he strolled along the beach, he threw the clay balls one by one out to the oceans as far as he could. The clay balls would fly and disappear in the ocean. The man threw several clay balls in the ocean until he dropped one of the balls and it cracked open. Inside the clay was a beautiful, precious stone. This excited the man and he started breaking the remaining clay balls. Each of it contained different types of precious stones. He found thousands of dollars worth of jewels in around 20 clay balls that was left with him. He had been on the beach for a long time and he must have thrown away many clay balls with hidden treasure into the sea. He could have had a treasure worth of tens of thousands rather than just thousands if he had not thrown the clay balls away. Most of the time we look at someone or even ourselves and we see the external clay vessel. The vessel doesn't always look sparkly and nice, so we never bother to look inside it. We tend to see and judge a person and deem them as less important than the ones who are more beautiful, stylish, well-known, or wealthy. We forget to look inside for the unique treasure that each one of us holds. May we not come to the end of our lives and realize that we have thrown away a fortune in friendship, love, or any relationship because we did not attempt to look for the gems hidden in bits of clay. Let us all relish the treasures each of us holds inside us.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Just being creative in life, in finding solutions, being able to think outside the box when we are stuck in a box. What being able to look beyond the curb, look beyond that dead end, beyond that wall, it requires creativity. Being able to trust in God and rely on what He has for you tomorrow is thinking outside.